Welcome to New Books and Popular Music, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. In this episode, I talk with Andy Neal about his book, Had Me a Real Good Time, Faces Before, During, and After, published in 2011 by Omnibus Press. A fantastic rock band, Faces emerged from the wreckage of two other influential bands, Small Faces and the Jeff Beck Group. They went on to be one of the more successful commercially and critically acclaimed bands of the early 70s and, especially for two Faces, Ron Wood and Rod Stewart, superstars in their own right. Wood with the Rolling Stones and Stewart as a solo artist. As the book's title suggests, Neal provides a richly detailed history of the five members' pre-Faces careers, their tenure with the Faces, and what has become of them since the dissolution of the band. Of note is Neal's exhaustive history of just about anyone who had any connection to the band. Roadies, producers, label executives, wives, other musicians, and more. At this point, Had Me a Real Good Time must be seen as the definitive history of Faces, an important band that was an important part of an important rock scene. Andy Neal is also the co-author of Any Way, Anyhow, Anywhere, The Complete Chronicle of The Who, as well as compiling Across the Universe, The Beatles on Tour and on Stage. He writes liner notes as well as consults on biographies and documentaries. Neal's writing has appeared in Mojo, Record Collector, and Ugly Things. He lives in London, which is where I reached him for this interview. Hello, Andy, and welcome to New Books and Popular Music.
Hi, Matt.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Great. Why don't we start off by you giving us a bit of your biography. Tell us about yourself, please.
Well, I've sort of been writing about popular music, particularly the 1960s and 70s, which I guess is my era. I've been doing it now professionally for about the last 10 years or so. But it's always been an interest of mine, and I've just always been sort of involved in, you know, either contributing to other projects or my own projects, and it's just been an ongoing thing, really.
Mm-hmm. And so you say it's your era. This is your time as a teenager and a young adult, the late 60s, early 70s?
Probably the 70s more. I was a little bit too young. I just missed out on the 60s, although I caught somebody at the end of the 60s. I have memories of that. But the 70s was probably the time that I was getting into new music, but also at the same time checking out what was happening, you know, from that period that had just gone, you know, because there was so much good stuff that was that had happened that I sort of was a little bit, I'm the youngest of four brothers and sisters, so I sort of lived it vicariously through them, if you like, you know.
Uh-huh. And did you grow up in London?
Yes.
And so how did you come, you've written a book about The Who, how did you come to write about The Faces specifically?
Well, it sort of was a byproduct of, a lot of the work that I'd done with The Who, that both bands were connected in many ways. You know, they came out at roughly the same time, and in 1964, 65 in London, and, there was a lot of parallels there where they were sort of both came from the mob movement that was happening in England at the time. And, sort of they had a sort of a similar empathy, if you like. And also Pete Townshend and Ronnie Lane became very close friends. And Keith Moon was also a very close friend of Ronnie Lane's too. So there were these sort of parallels. And after I'd done the Who book, I thought that, you know, there'd been biographies on predominantly on Rod Stewart, but there hadn't really been a book that sort of looked at all five members of the band as an entity or separately, and sort of explored their roots, you know, how they came out of sort of the same sort of club scene in London, and they all happened to end up together in the end of the 60s and sort of started this band that would sort of go on to be very successful in the 70s. So I guess, yeah, the groundwork had been laid when I was, you know, when I'd done the Who book, and then it just sort of seemed right to do a book on the Faces.
Did you ever see the Faces live?
No, I missed them. I was just a little bit too young. It was at the time where I wasn't old enough to see shows, although my sister, who's older than me, saw them in about 1970. I think she saw them in 74. Uh-huh. Which was after Ronnie Lane had left, and they were just a little bit, they were still a great live band, but, you know, that they changed once Ronnie Lane had left and Tetsu Yamauchi came in on bass. You know, the dynamic had changed. And, of course, they didn't last for that much longer. I think they only lasted for about another year and a half. So, unfortunately, I just missed them.
Right.
I was always a big fan. I always had the records.
Yeah.
You know, I could afford the records. I just couldn't afford the concert tickets. All the concert tickets sold out before I could get a chance to get to see them, you know.
I remember my my sister, who's just a few years older than me. I was looking in the back of the book. You have their complete tours from the band, and
right. Yeah.
I remember I grew up in San Diego in California, and I remember that when I was young, being jealous that she saw the Faces with Loggins and Messina in San Diego, and I remember that when I looked at your book.
Right, that would be 1975.
1975, yeah.
I think that was one of the last tours they did.
According to your book, it was they had two tours that year.
That was ironically, you know, they from you know when they first went to America, but right up to that last tour, especially those last two tours, you know, they were so popular in America. If you look at those tour schedules, they're just playing all over America. You know,
right. And where she saw them, it was, I think it's called Balboa Stadium, and it probably holds,
right.
I don't know, 8,000 people or so.
That's right, yeah.
Well, let's get into your book proper then. The beginning is kind of biographies of the band members and where they grew up. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the era when they were all born in the mid-40s, at the end of World War II or just after the end of World War II. And you spend some time talking about, you know, the influence that World War II had definitely on their parents' generation and on them. Can you talk about their early histories, their biographies, please?
Well, I definitely think the war and that sort of post-war or the baby boomer generation that they were part of definitely sort of had an insight, formed how they would develop. That sort of very much gang mentality, if you like, all for one for all, because, you know, Britain in the, you know, straight after the war, it was a country of deprivations. You know, there was what they called rationing over here, where, you know, luxuries like sugar and even things like bananas and all that, you know, it was all rationed because those luxuries, you know, the war had just sort of wiped out things that I guess the Americans would take for granted, you know, because it was for the first 10 years after the war, from like 45 to the mid-50s, you know, Britain was a nation that was rebuilding itself, and rationing was a part of that. So all the guys in the Faces, that in fact, there's a few quotes in there where Ronnie Lane's brother remembers, his elder brother remembers sort of playing on the ruins as a kid, you know, and or going down to the local market to look for jumbles, rags with his father. And of course, all these early experiences would turn up in songs later on from the band looking back, you know, particularly Ronnie Lane. The one I was referring to then was Debris, of course, which was on A Nod as Good as a Wing. But even Rod would look back to his childhood in things like Every Picture Tells a Story, just, you know, that early sort of working class life that they all had, because they were all from a working class background. You know, they didn't own their own homes. You know, they weren't from sort of like relatively wealthy families. You know, they were from that generation that came up after the war. And also, I think that was the thing that was crucial later on, is that they'd all shared that same experience. I think if they'd been from different backgrounds, if sort of one was wealthier than the other or had come from a different, more classier background, then it may have affected them, that wouldn't have worked. But because they'd shared that whole sort of common breeding, if you like, then it was definitely something that was proved to be advantageous later.
Mm-hmm. How about the popular music scene that they grow up in? So they probably start being aware of popular music in the mid to late 50s and into the early 60s. What kind of influences are the members having, and what kind of pop music scene is happening in England at that time?
Well, it was a very watered down pop scene. I mean, you guys were spoiled because you had rock and roll. I mean, you know, rock and roll started in 54, 55, and Britain was very, you know, the records were coming out over here, you know, like you'd hear Bill Haley and Elvis Presley, and and things like that. But, you know, it took a long time, and some would argue it took until the Beatles for Britain to sort of actually produce its own sort of convincing or genuine version of rock and roll. But the guys and the Faces were listening to that, but in fact they had quite diverse influences. I mean, Rod Stewart is a case in point. I mean, his parents were big fans of Al Jolson, and he would remember his earliest musical sort of memory is, you know, being around the house and hearing old Al Jolson 78 that his mother would play. Rod was sort of the youngest of, I think, five children, and, you know, he came from a musical family, so there was always music playing around, but he just remembers that sort of almost like the old show tunes, if you like. Mm-hmm. He came from that background. Similarly, Ronnie Wood, when he was growing up in West London, his two elder brothers were into jazz, people like Bix Beiderbecke and all that sort of old traditional New Orleans jazz. And rock and roll came a bit later for him, you know, with his brother Skiffle Group. Now, Skiffle, just briefly, was a sort of a very British phenomenon in the fact that all these sort of exotic instruments like Fender guitars and drum kits and all that, you know, were way out of the reach of the average teenager who, you know, aspired to play music. So these guys would get old washboards and you know, as a T-chest bass, as a stand-up bass, and then make their own music. And Ronnie Wood's first gig was actually playing in his local cinema in between the movie shows, playing this former Skiffle. So that was how, you know, that was his introduction to it. And of course, you know, Ronnie Lane and Ian McClagan, they'd all listen to people like Buddy Holly, and you know, there's a story in there. Ian McClagan remembers hearing, you know, Rock Around the Clock at his cousin's birthday party or his sister's birthday party. I have to go back to the book and refer to that. But, you know, so they're all hearing music either through their sort of elder brothers or sisters, or they just heard it by chance on the radio, or their parents, or, you know, so the real sort of diverse stew, if you like, that they brought to their influences. They're not really what you'd expect from, you know, particularly with Rod, with an influence like Al Jolson. You know, you'd expect somebody perhaps like Elvis or Gene Vincent or something like that. But no, it stretches back even further.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned that in the book that there's a moment where in the 60s, and this is, I think, about the time when Small Faces are forming and the Yardbirds, and later on the Jeff Beck Group and the Birds,
yeah,
the British Birds, where you say that London changes from more of an R&B based scene to a psychedelic blues and rock scene.
That's right. I mean, it all seemed to coalesce in London around about 1965, 66. I mean, 63, 64 was when rhythm and blues, you know, the sort of Chicago rhythm and blues was being popularized by people like Alexis Corner, who, of course, was a big influence on the Rolling Stones. And previously, these clubs in London, like the Marquee Club, had been catering to jazz, you know, to traditional jazz, what have you, and then suddenly this rhythm and blues thing came in, and then from then on it just became obvious that there were a lot of groups that were sort of, it had started off on a rhythm and blues kick and were probably quite sincere in what they were playing, but there was such a diverse amount of influences that were happening in London at the time that the music mutated, and people were sort of hearing American soul music for the first time, you know, the Stax sound, and of course Pamela Motown, which wasn't, I mean, Pamela was a big, was quite popular in America, but it was almost like a cult music in Britain. It didn't really hit the hit parade until a bit later, so all these guys were playing it. And Rod was a big Motown fan, you know, he loved the Temptations, and of course the Faces went on to cover a few Temptations tunes. And then, yes, and as you say, 66 into 67 was when the drug culture was starting to permeate everything, and the music was changing. But you know, apart from the Small Faces with, say, Ichiku Park and a few of the tracks on Ogden's Nutcombe Like, maybe a few other things. Here Comes the Night is maybe another example. They weren't really a sort of a what you would sort of typify as a psychedelic group, and neither was the Jeff Beck group. In fact, the Jeff Beck group were very much like a contemporary blues group, like, say, Canned Heat or some other similar band in America. They weren't really into that sort of what you would call like a psychedelic group like Pink Floyd or the Grateful Dead or anything like that. They didn't really, that whole thing bypassed the guys in and their bands that they were in at the time before the Faces. And that's quite interesting, really, that they weren't really a part of that.
So then let's concentrate. I mean, there's a lot of groups that you write about that are pre-Faces, but let's concentrate on Small Faces and Jeff Beck Group. Tell us, you know, briefly give us a summary of Small Faces, please.
Well, the Small Faces were one of Britain's most popular groups in the mid-60s, and they were quite underrated at the time because they were sort of unfairly saddled, in my view, with a sort of pop group tag, because they were all sort of had a similar image. They're all small. They're all quite cute. I mean, Steve Marriott was sort of like the pin-up, and tended to overshadow their music. I mean, they were very successful in Britain. I mean, I think they had something like 10 top 10 hits, and, you know, because they were always sort of in the charts and on the radio and things like that, you know, they weren't considered as serious. That they had a different image from, say, a band like The Who or The Yardbirds or something like that. They were considered maybe a little bit more hipper or a bit more credible, if you like. But, you know, they were actually a very fresh, original band, and they worked as a unit so well. They were so cohesive. They fed off with another, and as soon as Ian McLagan joined, it was almost like the missing piece of a jigsaw. And you know, they just image wise, music wise, they just, in my view, recorded some of the best singles, some of the best music from that time that has worn very well. And similarly with the Jeff Beck Group, you know, the Jeff Beck Group were put together after Jeff had left the Yardbirds, or was pushed from the Yardbirds, whichever version you believe.
Right.
But, yeah, and again, they were more, not so much on record, but more as a live act, that they really delivered the goods live, because Beck wasn't necessarily a front man, and that's where Rod came into the picture, and this is what sort of was like Rod's apprenticeship, if you like. I mean, he'd been in groups before, but suddenly with the Jeff Beck Group, and because Beck was such a cult hero in America from his time in the Yardbirds, by the time the Beck Group first came to America in 1968 and debuted at the Fillmore East in New York City, there was an audience already there, primed, waiting for them, primarily because of Jeff Beck's reputation. But they got one hell of a shock when they heard this guy with a really raspy voice singing like Sam Cooke or Otis Redding, you know, just singing sort of quite heartfelt blues. That they weren't expecting that. They weren't, and it's quite a well-known story that Rod was so nervous at that debut show that to start with, he started singing from behind the amplifiers. And people in the audience were wondering where this voice was coming from, because, you know, he thought everyone was there to see Jeff Beck. They wouldn't be interested in sort of seeing him. So that was Rod Stewart's introduction to America.
Mm-hmm. And this is for your story and the story of the Faces, an important distinction. I think that Jeff Beck Group, they went to America and Small Faces never did, correct?
That's correct, yeah. It's always this thing that, like, you know, the Small Faces were considered the band that should have made it. You know, there so many British groups were going to America. You know, you sort of had that initial British invasion of the Beatles and the Dave Clarks and the Herman's Hermits and what have you. And then it was this thing that the next wave were going to be coming over, and that included people like The Move and Jimi Hendrix The Who and Jimi Hendrix. Even though Jimi Hendrix was American, you know, he had to go to England to become known, and then, you know, he was due to come back, and all these other bands that were sort of on the cusp of coming into America, sort of in the back, before, if you like, people like Traffic and Procol Harum and all these sort of bands. But because the Small Faces weren't that well known in America, none of their records had charted, it was very hard to get a visa to tour America. The Musicians Union were very strict. And to try and get a visa to tour, or, you know, was difficult. I mean, the Yardbirds had incredible problems when Jeff Beck first came over. You know, the trip was delayed while all these applications were looked at. And you really had to have a hit single, or you had to have some sort of merit or distinction to do that. And the Small Faces didn't have that, because until Ichiku Park came out in 1967, they were sort of an unknown quantity. They were only really a cult group. And as I said in the book, by the time they finally were in a position to come over and do the gig, Mac, Ian McClagan, the organist, the band got busted. And, of course, if he had a drug conviction in those days, you couldn't get a visa to enter America for at least a year. And, of course, that would have taken them through to 68 or 69. And, of course, that was when Steve Marriott decided that he wanted to leave the band. So the original Small Faces never did get to America. More's the pity.
So then tell us about then the dissolution of both Small Faces and Jeff Beck Group, and then the creation of Faces out of that, please.
Well, the Small Faces had sort of been together for about 3 years or so, and they'd had this pop image, which was quite grating on them, because they felt that they were sort of worth more than that. And it was particularly galling to Steve Marriott, because being the front man, he was sort of like the focal image of the group. But it was also at a time when, you know, the supergroups were coming through, you know, and music was getting quite serious with, you know, the psychedelic and the progressive music that was around in the late 60s, early 70s, the drug culture, et cetera, et cetera. And Steve felt that he wanted to be a part of that, or accept it as something that was more than just sort of like a pop group, if you like. So quite unexpectedly, he decided to quit the group. You know, he announced it on New Year's Eve of 1968, and he left the band in the early part of 69. And so the other guys in the Small Faces, Ronnie Lane, Ian McClagan, and Kenny Jones, were sort of left in the lurch, if you like, and didn't know where to turn. And initially they were going to break up, but they sort of decided to stick together. And around about the same time, the Jeff Beck Group, who'd been sort of touring to great success in America, and they'd released the Truth album, which was quite a big radio hit in America, and you know, it was getting airplay, and you know, they were selling out concert halls. But the Jeff Beck Group was such an unstable band at the best of times that in between American tours, Jeff Beck decided to fire the rhythm section, which was Ronnie Wood on bass and Mickey Waller, the drummer. Now, Ronnie had always been a fan of the Small Faces, so when he'd heard that Steve Marriott had left them, he sort of rang up Ronnie Lane out of the blue and said, you know, let's get together and maybe work some ideas out and get a band together. So they had nothing else to lose, so they just sort of got together. And, of course, Rod was still in the Jeff Beck Group at this point, but he was still, and he still is to this day, a very close friend of Ronnie Wood's. So he was curious to know what this old pal was up to. And so he started to drop in on these sort of informal rehearsals that they were having down in the Rolling Stones' old rehearsal studio in South London. And initially he wasn't singing, he was just sort of hanging out. And because, you know, of their backgrounds and the fact they shared a sense of humour that was very similar, they were just sort of hanging out, really. And Rod wasn't really taking it that much seriously, or even considering probably of wanting to sing with them. But they were gradually getting better and better. And because the situation with Beck was always so unpredictable, and when Beck finally cancelled an American tour midway through, which was to have included Woodstock, they came back, and that's when Rod decided, you know, I'm going to just throw in my lot with Ronnie Wood and these guys who used to be in the Small Faces, and take it from there. And that's really how they got together.
Mm-hmm. they invited him to be the singer, didn't they? Or
that's right. Well, it was obvious that he was good when he sang with them, that it worked, that it gelled. But there was a problem in that Ian McCracken and Ronnie Lane in particular were wary of getting in another lead singer type, if you like, of the type that they'd experienced with Steve Marriott, because, you know, the ego problems or the fact that, you know, all the attention would be directed to the lead singer, that so they were a bit sort of hesitant to jump right in and invite right in. But as Kenny Jones has said on many occasions, even as the drummer sitting at the back of these rehearsals, he could tell the considerable difference that Rod made to the band once he started getting up there and playing and singing with them. So it was Kenny who first took Rod for a drink before one of the rehearsals and said, you know, how'd you fancy joining up with us? And Rod said, well, do you think it'd work? And he said, yeah, I'll have a word to the other guys. And for the reasons I've just mentioned, Lane and McLagan were initially against it. Of course, Ronnie Wood was delighted because, you know, Rod was his friend and, you know, good. He could see how it would work. But those two were the ones that needed convincing, and eventually they were convinced and it worked. But, of course, it caused problems later on.
Were they seen at the time as a super group, like Cream or something, or?
No, not at all. Not in this country. In fact, it might surprise some people to discover that they were actually considered a bit of a joke in this country. Maybe not so much a joke, but, you know, they weren't rated very highly, mainly because they were seen as the sort of leftovers or the remnants of two successful bands. It was almost seen as some sort of like desperate move for these guys to get together because, you know, Steve Marriott had gone off to Humble Pie, and for many people, Steve Marriott, you know, was the voice and the songwriter and the Small Faces, even though the other guys in the band had a big part to play. And, you know, it was almost like, and also it has to be stressed that Rod Stewart and Ronnie Wood weren't that well known in Britain at the time. I mean, Rod was the singer with Jeff Beck, but Jeff Beck was far more well known in Britain than Rod was. And Ronnie Wood was just sort of the bass player in the Jeff Beck group. So they were almost like an unknown quantity. When I say an unknown quantity, I mean, you know, the Small Faces, of course, were very popular in Britain, but as a group, they certainly weren't considered a super group. If anybody was considered a super group, it would have been Humble Pie, who Steve Marriott formed with Peter Frampton. However, in America, they were much more receptive because Rod Stewart was well known through the Jeff Beck group, as was Ronnie Wood, and these guys who used to be in the Small Faces didn't have an image to live up to because they weren't well known in America. That they hadn't, apart from Ichiku Park, which was only really a minor hit in America, they weren't that well known. So there wasn't any sort of uphill climb that it felt like in England because, you know, these guys had more of a reputation to live down there, whereas in America it was almost like starting anew. And so they could go in and play in places like all those legendary venues in America, like the Fillmores and the Grandy Ballrooms in Detroit and the Electric Factory in Chicago or Philadelphia or wherever it was, and build up a reputation as a live band, whereas in Britain they were sort of considered unhip because they'd been in these bands before and that were sort of considered past their sell-by date, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, Faces concentrated on the United States rather than England, isn't that right?
That's very true, yes.
Mm-hmm. And again, talk a little bit more about why you think that their style of music, which, again, it's more of a blues-based rather than psychedelic-based, is more popular in America than in England at the time.
Well, I guess it had a lot to do with the way that the music was perceived, if you like. In America, you know, like especially in a venue like the Grandy Ballroom, you know, a band like the MC5, or, the, you know, particularly the MC5, you know, they would support know, but they were into, like, you know, having a, you know, creating a, you know, like an energetic show and getting people up and, you know, getting the audience to be more responsive than a sort of a band that would come on and play almost for their own enjoyment and bore the audience to tears. And with the Faces came from a similar sort of dynamic, or, you know, they were more interested in just getting the audience off rather than getting themselves off. You know, the audience participation was an integral thing right from the very start. Whereas in England, you know, there was a lot of these sort of bands that came through, you know, just naming some random names of people like, I don't know, Jethro Tull or King Crimson, who were a lot more sort of serious and a lot more sort of better musicians, but they didn't have that rapport with an audience where they could get them up and get them rocking and make them enjoy themselves. So when the Faces came to America for the first time in 1970, even as just a support act, it was obvious that these guys were good, and they were very good at what they did, but they were also, you know, they put on a great show, and they toured constantly. They're always touring through those early years. And, you know, of course, Rod had that reputation from the Jeff Beck Group, which helped. But leaving that aside, they were just a great live band from the word go. You know, I've heard recordings of some of those early shows they did in America, and you can tell that they're just, the audience is buzzing, because, you know, when they were on form, they were unbeatable.
Mm-hmm. And fairly quickly, Rod Stewart begins to stand out, at least, you know, in popular minds, and, you know, he starts becoming a star on his own. Talk for a while about, you know, about the tensions that created in the band, and, you know, how does one maintain the solo? I mean, Rod Stewart's becoming a genuine superstar fairly quickly, isn't he?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting, because Rod had already signed a solo recording deal even before he joined the Faces, because Rod was very much, he was always very shrewd, and he was always keeping an eye on, you know, his chances, or, you know, he was always hedging his bets. And when he was still with Jeff Beck, because he wasn't managed by Jeff Beck's manager, Peter Grant, who of course went on to manage Led Zeppelin as well, he was a free agent, really, in a way, to sign he could and he did sign a recording deal with a guy called Lou Reisner, who signed him to Mercury in America. And this was when Rod was just, you know, he was only sort of barely known as the guy who sang for Jeff Beck. He certainly didn't have any sort of solo credentials or anything like that. But Lou Reisner, so Rod had signed this deal with Mercury Records, and I think it was for 4 albums or something. And when he joined the Faces, they signed with Warner Brothers, but there was a special dispensation made where Rod could record with the Faces for Warner Brothers as long as he you know, promoted his albums for Mercury. So Rod had put out a couple of albums, the Rod Stewart album in America and Gasoline Alley, each one selling more than the last. And it became pretty obvious that Rod's albums worked better than the Faces albums to that point. But they didn't sell, you know, they sold respectably, but not in huge numbers. But of course, that all changed in 1971 with Every Picture Tells a Story. And that was the album, of course, which contained Maggie May. And as soon as Maggie May started, you know, getting airplay and became a hit, then the album started selling. And, of course, there was this amazing statistic where Rod was number one on the album charts and the singles charts in both America and Great Britain, which I don't think anyone has ever equaled. And, of course, you know, that created a great strain, because nobody... It took the Faces camp by surprise, because, you know, they knew that, you know, Rod was, you know, successful in his own right. People came to see him, not necessarily came to see the Faces. Even though the Faces were a great band, a lot of people came to hear Rod, you know, and up until that point, it's sort of been able to operate on an even keel. But, of course, soon as Rod had that massive success worldwide with the album and the single, you know, that it couldn't operate on the way it had anymore, because obviously Rod was going to get more and more attention, and it started to become increasingly Rod Stewart and the Faces, which caused great problems, you know, with promoters having to take signs down because it caused ill feeling with the other members, and a lot of jealousies and a lot of despite that it all caused. But they managed to keep a lid on it until eventually it got to the point where it really ground Ronnie Lane down in particular, and he just felt that he was writing all these songs that just couldn't be recorded by the Faces because they weren't really in that style, and he just felt that, you know, increasingly the spotlight was on Rod and rather than the band.
So talk about then, please, Ronnie Lane's end in the band. How did it come about?
Well, you know, Ronnie was always a distinctive songwriter going back to the Small Faces days. You know, he co-wrote with Steve, but they very much wrote apart as well. And so Ronnie had always been writing songs, and, you know, he has songs on those early Faces albums. But the way the Faces were, they were sort of a very ballsy, good time, you know, exuberant, flash rock and roll band. But the type of material that Ronnie was writing and preferred to play was a lot more sort of introspective, a bit more sort of folky or country vibe, if you like, or, you know, it was a lot more laid back than the sort of the all-out rockers that the Faces would deliver when they were live. And of course, Rod being the singer, you know, they couldn't, it just didn't work when, if they tried to do those sort of songs in the show, the songs that Ronnie was more, that was more sort of his style. And so Ronnie found that he was just writing all these songs that, you know, the realization dawned that he would never be able to, let alone record them, but not even, you know, sing them live. And it just became apparent that it was becoming more and more weighted towards Rod, in his view, than, you know, a democratic band, you know, where everything was sort of shared, even though it must be said that Rod always wanted just to be another guy in the band. But of course, you know, once he had that solo success, that was never going to work. And so I think that weighed down on him. And also he left his wife, and he'd met this sort of rather charismatic individual who he'd known for a few years, called Kate, who was quite influential in telling him that, you know, he could pursue this sort of nomadic gypsy lifestyle, you know, which I guess went back to his childhood, his East End childhood, you know, the game, the circus and things like that. So I think it was all these things being brought to bear, and he just decided that he wanted out. And when he first said it, you know, the others couldn't believe it, because, you know, they could understand his frustration with Rod, but, you know, Ronnie was very much the you know, it was his band in a way, you know, because when the Small Faces, you know, disintegrated, he was the one that sort of got the others together, and you know, he was the one that was sort of organizing the rehearsals, and he was in a way, you know, with the other guys in the Small Faces, particularly Mac and Kenny, you know, he'd been there all that time. So for him to suddenly leave, as he did in 1973, it was a shock. And the fact that, you know, we wouldn't have those great Ronnie Lane songs on the albums, like Debris and Ooh La La and things like that, you know, that wasn't going to work in the context of the Faces anymore, in Ronnie's view. So that's when he decided to bow out and pursue his own sort of vision, if you like, artistic vision.
Mm-hmm. And what about his replacement, Tetsu Yamauchi?
Tetsu had played with all of the Faces, particularly Rod. They're very big fans of Free, you know, Paul Rodgers' band. And what had happened was Tetsu was playing in England. He'd been in a band that had come over from Japan, and he'd ended up playing in Free, because Free were actually a very big band in Japan. So he'd filled in on bass I think he'd actually joined them at the time when Ronnie Lane decided to leave. And originally they were trying to get Pepsi's predecessor, a guy called Andy Fraser, who played bass in Free, but Andy Fraser turned them down. So Simon Kirk, the drummer with Free, said, well, you know, why don't you try out Pepsi? You know, he's a lot more easygoing and, you know, he's a good bass player, etc. And it was almost like it was a decision they made on, you know, in haste in a way, because although Tetsu was a good musician, he wasn't the same sort of bass player as Ronnie. And more crucially, he didn't have that sort of shared background that they all had. And also, he wasn't going to rock the boat like Ronnie would. You know, if Ronnie didn't like something in the band, you know, whether it was the choice of a song or, you know, whatever, you know, he would speak his mind, whereas Tetsu was this sort of Japanese guy who spoke very little English, who sort of just, you know, stood in the background. And the other thing, of course, is that, and the thing that I talk about in the book is that he drank twice as much as the band did,
which would be a lot.
which was going some, you know. So, you know, it wasn't really going to work.
Mm-hmm. Since you brought it up, talk about their, you know, part of their image. Drinking was a big part of their image, right?
That's right.
Had a bar on stage with a bartender, and did this? I mean, they were serious. They weren't pretending, right?
Oh no, they were dedicated juicers. I mean, right from the first American tour, you know, they used to buy cheap cases of the Tooth Rosé or whatever it was, and hand it out to the crowd to get the crowd blitzed as well. You know, it was all part of this sort of, we're all having a party together. You know, there's almost like there's no boundary between the stage, the band, and the audience. You know, this goes back, I think, to also, you know, how they weren't really a part of that whole drug culture. I mean, they'd all dabbled in the drug scene, and of course, cocaine went on to be quite a destructive part of what broke the band apart, but they were much more of a band that you would see in the Holiday Inn after the show, you know, keeping the bar open, you know, and ordering round after round of drinks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole thing. I mean, when they rehearsed in the early days, they would leave the rehearsal room and go down to the pub and, you know, have a few drinks, come back, rehearse some more, go back to the pub. You know, they started as they meant to continue.
Mm-hmm. Did it ever affect their playing? Did they ever have shows?
Absolutely. Some nights it helped, but often it didn't. And, you know, the faces is probably a good point to make now, is that on a good night, the faces were untouchable, but on a bad night, they were bad. And that was part of it. But it could be anything, and it wasn't just the booze. It could be just that there's, you know, the sound system wasn't right, or you know, there's a bit of a thing going between a couple of members that, you know, there might have been a little bit of unpleasantness or whatever. But generally, it was more the fact that sometimes they were just too incapacitated to deliver.
Right.
But it didn't happen that often. No. I mean, you know, it was more cases like, you know, if you look at those tour schedules, sometimes they're playing, you know, three shows, four shows on the trot, and sometimes that really tightened them up, but other times, you know, they'd be very tired and that would be reflected in their playing. So, you know, there's all sorts of reasons, really, but I guess the one that sticks the most is the fact that they just used to like, you know, imbibing, shall we say, before, during, and after a show.
It almost seems, and you do make the connection, and the connection can be seen, that it's a bit pre-punk rock with the connection between the crowd and the audience and the band. And then the obvious connection is Glenn Matlock of Sex Pistols, who now plays with Faces, right?
That's right. Well, I mean, Glenn was he's a classic example of a young British Faces fan. I mean, he liked them because, you know, they came from a similar background to him. They were singing about sort of subjects that he could relate to, like, you know, trying to go to a party and cop off with some girl and or while stealing their drinks, you know, all sorts of things. I was sort of like, you know, a young gang of lads who were out to have fun. And, you know, he responded to that. And the fact, too, that, you know, when they did play live, they weren't trying to exclude the audience or just saying, you know, hey, we've come to play to you, now you shut up and listen. The audience had to be a part of it, you know, and that stuck with him. And he loved their look as well, because a lot of that's the other thing, the Faces had such a great image as well. You know, they dressed well, they looked great, you know, and a lot of bands from those early 70s with, like, you know, long hair and denims and beards, and they just look, you know, no different from any other band that was, you know, there were so many bands that looked like that, whereas the Faces wore this really sort of they were very glamorous. They were glamorous and they looked distinctive, but they were also quite accessible, if you like, or, you know, people could relate to them. They weren't sort of like David Bowie, you know, Ziggy Stardust, you know, looking like an alien from outer space, or they weren't, you know, Brian Ferry or somebody, you know, dressed in a tuxedo, you know, sort of like trying to be very elegant. And you know, these guys, they looked great. They looked, I mean, Rod and Ronnie Wood looked like brothers, with the haircuts and the clothes and everything like that. But, you know, they were accessible. You know, they didn't jump into a limo and then hide themselves away up on the hotel rooms like Led Zeppelin did. They would be down at the bar, hanging out with the fans, you know, getting drunk, you know, meeting women, you know, whatever. You know, it was rock and roll, and that's what it should be.
How did this change as they start playing to more people? I mean, were they able to maintain this connection with the audience when they are playing to 10, 12, 15,000 people?
It got more and more difficult, obviously, but they were still, I mean, Rod was and always is and has been an entertainer, so he's always going to try and project to that person in the 115th row. You know, it's always a part of him that he feels he has to deliver a good show. And so he always tried to break down those barriers that came from playing those big shows, you know. Mm-hmm. Right to the end, you know, those last shows, obviously, you know, they were superstars by the end of it, but Rod always sort of tried to retain that common touch that always had.
And they would advertise their hotel, right, at the show?
Right, that's it. Yeah, there was no holds barred. They were just there to party down and to just, you know, they didn't consider themselves aloof, that, you know, they didn't want people to come back. They had dedicated fans. I mean, I there was one guy that I interviewed from St. Louis who used to follow the band around, you know, that sort of area, St. Louis, Chicago, Detroit, etc., you know, because they were the sort of band that attracted that sort of fan element, if you like, but not so much a fan, but they actually became friends with the band. You know, they got to know them, and, you know, the soccer ball would come out and they'd have a game of soccer up and down the corridors of the hotels, and you know, things would get out of hand, but it was sort of good, cool fun in a way. Okay, it did get out of hand when, you know, the police, the local sheriff's department got called, but it was never intended to be sinister. I mean, some of the stories you read of bands like Led Zeppelin, where it did get a little bit sinister. The Faces were just, you know, like a bunch of, I guess, like frat boys out there. I guess it was a bit like Animal House, you know, the John Belushi film.
Right. So then at some point, Ron Wood starts being courted by the Rolling Stones. When does this happen and how does that go?
Well, ironically, everyone associates Ronnie Wood with Keith, you know, the big Keith, little Keith type of thing. But funnily enough, the Stone that Ronnie first got friendly with was Mick Jagger, because Jagger was a big fan of the Faces. And, you know, he would check him out if and when he had the opportunity. And he got to know he got to know Ronnie quite well, because Ronnie's such a convivial guy, he's easy to get along with, and you know, they became good friends. And then in 1973, Keith and Ronnie got friendly, because Ronnie was starting to record his first solo album, and he was just like, you know, it was just like being on tour. He just invited everyone back to his house, except in this case, the people he invited back to his house were sort of like A-list musicians, like, you know, Mick Jagger and George Harrison and Billy Preston and all sorts of people. Just they were just his friends. And Keith sort of came back one night. He was invited back by Ronnie's then wife, Chrissy. And as he says, I came back for a night and I ended up staying there for 3 weeks. You know, they were just, you know, plug into certain substances and stay up all night recording and in that basement studio in Richmond, the house he had, which is now owned by Pete Townsend, the Wick. And that's how that the Stones connection happened. But you know, they were very close, but of course it doesn't take a genius to work out that Ronnie, you know, the Stones were his band, you know, ever since he saw them in 1963. And, you know, to get an offer or a possibility that he might be able to play with them, as what happened when Mick Taylor left the band in 1974, the Stones suddenly needed a guitarist. And Mick was sort of saying, you know, like, you know, who can you think of? And as Woody said, you know, I was screaming inside myself, it's me, you know, but you couldn't let the faces down, you know. But in a way, you know, like, it was, the writing was on the wall in 1975, you know, like, it was coming apart in a way, and Rod was getting bigger and bigger on the solo stakes. And, you know, when Ronnie sat in on the Stone summer tour that year, it was like, you know, hand in glove, you know, he fitted so well. So, you know, when he came back for that final Faces tour at the end of the year in 1975, you know, a few of the guys I spoke to said, you know, as soon as he walked into the rehearsal hall, you know, he'd left for that tour a face, but, you know, he walked into the rehearsal hall a Rolling Stone, and, you know, it was obvious that it wasn't going to last for much longer.
Mm-hmm. And then Rod, popular, you know, critical wisdom has it, and you mentioned Rod's change begins with the album Smiler, but, you know, everybody knows, you know, something happened with Rod where he kind of stops being a real rock and roller and becomes more of a pop star. Is this happening while he's with the Faces?
Well, he seems to have incredible taste and judgment for those sort of first four albums. You know, he didn't really put a foot wrong. You know, he had a great selection of songs to cover. His own songs that he wrote were absolute classics. Things like, you know, Maggie May and You Wear It Well, and my mind's gone blank for a second. True Blue, songs like that. You know, that he co-wrote with Ronnie Wood, who he co-wrote with a guy called Martin Quintington. You know, it just seemed that the production and he recorded the albums in about 2 or 3 weeks, and everything just seemed to gel. But then I think cocaine played a big part of it, and I also think, you know, the fact that he was being courted by the management and being groomed as a sort of a potential superstar on his own, and just the fact that, you know, he'd met Hollywood royalty and people like Brett Eklund, and that, I think it just changed him, really. You know, I don't think his voice was always the thing that sold the records, in a way. I mean, it was the fact that, you know, he'd been doing some incredible stuff like Gasoline Alley or I'd Rather Go Blind, which wasn't one of his songs, but, you know, and then in 3 short years he was doing things like Tonight's the Night and Do You Think I'm Sexy, you know, just songs that just that even he now feels, if, you know, if you catch him at a certain time, he feels inclined to disown, you know. It was just one of those things. But to be fair, it didn't just happen to Rod. It happened to a lot of rock and roll guys from the 60s and 70s where somebody once said that most of the most important musicians or artists their important work by the time they're 30. Now, Rod turned 30 in 1975. You know, Pete Townsend turned 30 in 1975. Mick Jagger turned 30 in 1973. And if you, you know, are bothered with these things, you start to notice that the quality deteriorates around about that time, you know.
Mm-hmm. Even though, yeah, their commercial success often, you know, Rod Stewart recently, you know, with these albums he's putting out, is he might be selling more than ever. I don't know.
That's right. Well, they have. I mean, the Great American Songbooks, that took everybody by surprise, including him. You know, I think he just did it because, you know, he had that life-threatening surgery on his vocal cords. He had a cancerous growth removed. Mm-hmm. And he had to learn to sing again, and those are the songs that sort of suited his voice, you know. Mm-hmm. And who was to know that they would be some of his biggest, if not his biggest selling albums of his career, I think.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but...
They're pretty close. So tell us, how do The Faces end?
Well, The Faces ended, I think it was almost like a natural end in a way. I mean, although it was a bit of a messy breakup because, you know, Rod was getting bigger and bigger, and he was recognized as Rod Stewart, the great superstar. But of course, the band now were being billed as Rod Stewart and the Faces, which was, you know, annoying to certain members of the band, particularly Ian McLagan. And even Ronnie Wood, who, you know, is quite easygoing, even, you know, he thought, well, hang on, you know, we started this band as the Faces, even though they're always being billed in America as Rod Stewart and the Faces by promoters to help sell tickets. So there was always this sort of uneasiness there. Even though they were still doing great business, they were touring and selling out places. But there was that thing over Rod being billed over the rest of the band and getting more attention. And also just Ronnie Wood, you know, had been courted by the Stones, and, you know, he was considering his options and looking towards, you know, his horizon as to what he was going to do, because, you know, you could see that maybe the wheels were going to come off fairly imminently. And so it just happened that the band was due to go back into the studio after that final 1975 tour and start recording a new album. And, you know, Rod didn't show up. And because Rod, by that point, had become a tax exile and was living in California. And Ronnie came back from that tour and went straight to, I believe, Montreux in Switzerland and started recording the Black and Blue album with the Stones. So Kenny Jones, Ian McLagan, and Tetsu were sort of there wondering what was happening. And then when it was becoming obvious that Ronnie had pretty much become the Rolling Stone in all but name, Rod announced, totally, according to Ian McLagan, he had no idea that it was about to happen. Rod gave an interview to one of the big tabloids over here in Britain, the Daily Mirror, saying that he'd left the Faces because he was tired of his guitarist being on permanent loan to the Rolling Stones, quote unquote. And so that was it, really. I mean, they staggered on into 1976. They gave interviews to the music press saying that they were going to record with or without Rod, you know, and but of course they booked some sessions and Ronnie Wood never turned up, and it was pretty obvious that that was it, the end of the game. So it sort of went out with a whimper, really, rather than one sort of, like, you know, huge farewell concert or something like that. You know, that was the end of it.
And then, now jumping ahead 35 years, they've played a few shows, a couple. What are they doing now? What are Faces up to now?
Well, this year, of course, is a big year for them because the Faces and the Small Faces, under one umbrella, are being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on April 14th in Cleveland. So they're sort of finally getting overdue recognition. So whether they'll do any shows around that or whether they'll just play the ceremony, I've no idea. There's no word what the Stones are up to, if anything, this year. They're celebrating their 50th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
So Ronnie Wood would be available. Whether they're going to do any more shows, with the singer Nick Hutnell. I've yet to hear of any definite plans, but you never know. We could be surprised. We could see a tour with Rod, possibly not. But it would be good at least if they just do several shows, several selected shows as sort of one last, you know, laying the ghost, if you like, of the band.
Right. Well, thanks, Andy. It's a great book. What are you up to now? Are you working on a new book of any kind?
I'm resting. I've got a few ideas for various projects, a few irons in the fire, just waiting to see where they'll end up, but nothing definite as yet.
Okay, well, again, I've always been a big fan of Faces and early Rod Stewart, some of my favorite music ever, and I think your book is, at least at this point, has to be the definitive Faces biography. So thank you for being on our show.
Well, thank you, Matt. It's been a pleasure. It's been good talking to you, and I hope people who are listening to this will go out and read it and just appreciate how much of a great band the Faces really were.
I hope so. Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation with Andy Neal about his book, Had Me a Real Good Time, Faces Before, During, and After, published by Omnibus Press in 2011. Check back with New Books in Popular Music regularly for more interviews with authors of books about popular music. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. Thanks for listening.